This is an ABC podcast.
This is The Money on RN and wherever you get your podcasts, and I am Richard Aidy. Russia is facing unprecedented financial sanctions in the wake of its invasion of Ukraine. What they are, what they mean, we'll get to later in the show. We begin with the floods on the East Coast. It's very clear that this is a disaster. What isn't clear is the size of the hit to the economy. Nikki Hutley is an independent economist and she's with the Climate Council. I spoke to her earlier and started by asking what we know about how much this is going to cost.
Well, we're still adding things up, but yesterday Standard & Poor's came out and said that the insured losses could be as much as $1 billion, maybe even $2 billion, which would make this one of the worst floods on record. And we know, of course, that insured losses are only a small proportion of the total. There's not only those properties and businesses that are uninsured, but of course we have disruption to businesses, people absent from work or maybe present at work, but low productivity. Because they're distracted by mental health, anxiety, dealing with insurance claims, those sorts of things. Mm. So the losses will probably be, this could well be one of our worst disasters.
Yeah, so as of yesterday, the Insurance Council had more than 48,000 claims and that had gone up 53% on the day before. So let's assume it's going to keep going. I get that it's hard to put a price on it. Can we use the costs from past disasters to get more of a ballpark?
So I think we can, and there's two particularly useful ones. The first, of course, is those dreadful 2010-11 floods in Queensland, which the Queensland Chief Scientific Officer estimates was worth around $30 billion in lost economic activity overall. And then, of course, there were the 2019 floods, which were close to $7 billion. So somewhere in between those estimates, we've got a range. It's probably going to be higher rather than lower, but it will depend on one of the things we're not hearing so much about at the moment. The focus is rightly on what's happening to individuals. We less information around what's happening to agriculture, to livestock, to industry delays. How are things getting out? Roads are blocked. So
I remember in Queensland,
how is all that going?
Queensland 10 years ago or 11 years ago now, they had coal mines flooded and things like that. And of course, that takes a while to come back from.
Yes. And that was obviously billions of dollars because, that's a huge part of our export revenue and a part of our economy. But fortunately, those sorts of things, you are able to recoup some of that. Lost production, not so much, but certainly getting things that have been delayed out. What tends to happen, though, at the moment is, particularly what we've seen in COVID is services. If you missed a haircut, you don't then go and have two haircuts the next week. So there will be things that, people are missing out. There's no food on a lot of shelves. We're hearing stories. Again, you don't go back and buy that food. So there'll be things that we don't catch up on.
Now, I don't have to tell you, Nikki, that this comes in the week of the latest IPCC report, which points that we're going to get much, much more of the same if we don't cut our emissions dramatically.
Yes, and we know that for every 1 degree warming, we get, I think it's close to a 10% increase in intensity of rainstorms and therefore flooding. So this is directly embedded as a result of failing to address our emissions. We cannot afford to not deal with this. By some estimates, we could be having costs in, a hundred of trillions of dollars cumulatively by the end of the century if we don't act. Already, even on a moderate path with emissions, we're talking about $30 to $40 billion a year just from floods by 2060. These numbers are just, eye-watering.
Yeah, in fact, by 2030, I think in that report it said $19 billion lost to farmers and broader agricultural industry in Australia, $4 trillion lost by the end of the century, just for agriculture, not counting everything else. Deloitte did a report for the Australian Business Roundtable for Disaster Resilience and Safer Communities. I know you're familiar with it. That really unpicks this whole issue, doesn't it?
Yes, and it takes all of the different types of natural disasters and looks at what climate change is going to do in terms of increased frequency, as well as, of course, the fact that our population is increasing, and with that, the built environment increases. So there's more property to be damaged by these worse events. And we know that we're talking about $90 billion across all different types of disasters by 2060, and around $42 billion of that is just to floods.
The thing that I remember about that report that surprised me, because I thought this will be, you know, mostly about the north, it's where we have the cyclones, but two-thirds of the costs from natural disasters will be in Queensland and New South Wales.
Yes, and that's the thing, is that with climate change, a lot of those, you know, tropical cyclones, the flooding, the rain, is moving further south over time with temperature changes and sea level temperature changes. So we are going to see more of that in New South Wales. I mean, we're already affected, but yes, two-thirds, New South Wales and Queensland, we will bear the brunt of that. And a third of those costs are directly due to worsening climate change. The rest is because the population's increasing.
Mm. Now, Nikki, I know you're very interested in resilience. And interestingly, the Insurance Council put out a report just last week calling for governments, state and federal, to actually invest significantly more than they are.
Yes, so they have put out a shopping list, if you like, about the types of things that we can invest in. And in fact, you know, work that I was doing nearly a decade ago now for Suncorp was looking at the value of investing in levees in flood loan prone towns. And we had benefit cost ratios of 5 to 1. So, you know, they more than pay for themselves. But local councils often need state or even federal government to help them with the cash. And this is exactly what the Insurance Council is looking for. So, you know, $500 million in flood levies. If we had done that, we would be having far less damage now. You can see an example like Roma in Queensland that have benefited from, you know, putting in levies that have saved, you know, hundreds of properties there. So we need to not only protect against floods, but of course, cyclone-proofing homes in northern Australia with shuttering and battens for roofs. You know, all of these things are required, and they will reduce the cost to the economy overall. We know that even if we act on climate change now, we are on a path to more extreme events, unfortunately, and we have to invest in resilience. This is, you know, essential for our economy and for our social, you know, mental health and well-being as well.
They're asking for the Australian government, so half federal, half state, to lift funding to $2 billion over the next 5 years. Before COVID, I think we'd have all said, well, that's a lot of money. COVID has taught us that actually sums can be significantly larger than that for public benefit. But if we do that, it's estimated to save us $19 billion at least in the long term by 2050.
Yeah, look, the cost benefit on this just adds up. It is a no-brainer. And if we're going on the evidence, if you're just taking the economics into account, this should be done, and it should be done ASAP. There is no reason not to go ahead with spending this sort of money. You know, we had COVID recovery plans around the world. In Australia, we spent less than about 2% of our COVID budget on anything to do with climate change. Countries like France, Germany spent 50%, Canada 75%. We have done very poorly on these comparative measures.
We've still got to make that step change. And you would think in this week in particular, when the IPCC says Australia, of the wealthy countries, is probably going to cop it harder than anybody else.
And we've known this for such a long time, Richard. You know, for the last decade in particular, we've been saying we must act now, we must act now. Australia is more vulnerable. We've already got 1.5 degree warming, even though the average for the globe is 1.1 degree. You know, we are incredibly vulnerable, and the economics on this just stacks up. There is just no excuse not to be acting.
That is where we'll leave it, Nikki. Thank you very much for joining us again on The Money.
Thank you, Richard.
Economist Nikki Hutley, and this is The Money with me, Richard Aidy. Now, since I spoke to Nikki, the Insurance Council has updated its figures. So far, insurance companies have received more than 60,000 claims now, and the current cost is estimated at about $800 million. Now, these numbers are easy to measure, but they're not enough. Mehmet Yulubasoglu, who's at Deakin Business School, says the way we take stock of disasters isn't capturing the full extent of their damage.
Typically, we would like to attach a dollar figure, a dollar value to a disaster in terms of its impact on lost properties, infrastructure, goods and services. So that gives us a direct damage estimate. There is an alternative way of looking at that, like insurance claims. which typically go hand in hand with the direct damage estimates. And obviously, all these make sense because lost homes and properties need to be replaced. Insurance claims are tangible. So they give us an idea about what the cost of disasters are. And this is the economic space. In another space, typically in the health space, there is increasing awareness about the effects of disasters on mental health and health of the individuals. But in the economics domain, the focus is currently on the direct damages to the built environment.
Yeah, but what are we missing? What are we failing to take account of?
At the moment, we are not taking into account two things, the broader flow-on impacts of disasters. When disasters strike, typically economic activity is paused. Some economic activity is lost forever. So that has effects on individuals and their income levels, not only for a short period, but also a long period. So the income effects of disasters are there as flow-on impacts. There is impact on the fiscal system. There is impact on the savings and consumption decisions of the individuals. Also, in another dimension, the economic impact of disasters, is not borne equally across different demographic and sectoral groups. You know, the disasters have unequal impacts on different segments in the society. So typically these dimensions, you know, need more focus and more research to come to the surface.
It's also difficult to get insurance for some of the things that disasters bring, especially with climate change making things worse. And I'll return to that a bit later. So you had a look at this. What did you do?
Yes, we did look at this in two dimensions. One is at the micro level. Another is at the macro level. So at the macro level, recently we have analyzed the data from 47 floods and 36 bushfires in Australia during this period, 1978 to 2014. And we looked at the effects of those disasters on the state's economic output. We went further and had a bit of a more disaggregated view also, and we looked at the output of the sectors, each sector within each state, and how they changed as a result of floods and bushfires. And for that, we looked at the ABS National Accounts data, and the Australian Bureau of Statistics provide data for 18 different sectors. And we looked at how the output of those sectors changed in the disaster year and in the following year to make sense of the macroeconomic impact of the disasters.
So you looked at agriculture and construction and retail and transport, public sector as well. You looked at about 10, didn't you?
Yes, exactly. We looked at 10 most relevant sectors, like you said, agriculture, construction, mining, manufacturing, recreation, retail, real estate and financial services, transport, utilities, and the public sector.
What did you find?
Well, floods do a lot of damage to the sectoral output. They do most damage. Mining, we found that the mining output was down by about 10 to 12% in the disaster year and in the following year. And agriculture was down by 5 to 6% again in the disaster year in the following year. Indeed, Australia lost 2 years' worth of agricultural output during this 40-year period as a result of floods. Construction was down, property and financial services was down, wholesale and recreation output was also down in the disaster years and later. We didn't find any effect on the manufacturing. Some sectors experienced higher output as a result of disasters, like public and emergency management, utility services, and transport and communications.
Right. Well, that makes sense too, as states roll out through enterprises to rebuild. We'll leave aside the bushfires because, as you said, the floods are the worst, and of course, they're what we're going through now. Are there other economic effects of disasters? I'm thinking you did touch on the fact that they seem to affect some people more than others.
Exactly. Yeah, there are other dimensions of disaster effects. We found that in Australia, disasters increase income inequality. Typically, low-income individuals are more adversely affected compared to middle and high-income individuals. In a way, the poor becomes poorer after disasters. And the reason for that is most of the low-income individuals work in disaster-sensitive sectors like agriculture, food and accommodation, and so on. And there are also some demographic sensitivities. For instance, the female workforce is mostly a part-time worker, and therefore they are categorized in the low-income category. Part-time employees compared to full-time employees tend to lose out more. Small businesses compared to larger businesses tend to lose out more. So there are such sensitivities, demographic and sectoral, that are mapped into the income scale, low-income, middle-income, and high-income. And we found that the income gap diverges between low-income and other income categories.
Somehow I knew it wasn't going to be the wealthy who were going to suffer the most. But anyway.
Yeah, even if they suffer, they tend to recover more quickly compared to others.
Indeed. How well is this understood, Mehmet, that we need to take into account these flow-on effects in our reckoning of costs?
Essentially, the research is just being made on these issues. They are just coming to the surface. And it is not only the income and income inequality effects of disasters, but there are other dimensions that are being researched and undisclosed yet. I can quote one of my PhD students' work, Ms. Merve Küçük, who submitted her thesis from Deakin University just yesterday on the undisclosed costs of disasters on households and governments. For example, in one chapter, she finds that after Queensland floods 2010 and 11, there was about $500 million decline in the tax payables. So the fiscal system also suffered as a result of that disaster in terms of collecting less tax revenue. And that's because also incomes were a bit lower, but also individuals claimed more tax deductions. So that's one undisclosed effect on the system. Another effect that my student was able to find was the increase in retirement savings. So after disasters, individuals tend to deposit more to their superannuation accounts because of the change in risk preferences.
Yeah.
They find it to be riskier to live in a disaster prone zone, and they increase their retirement savings, which means less money spent on consumption today for more savings maybe 30 years later.
Yeah. So that having been through a rainy day, in the case of a flood, they're saving for the next rainy day, we could put it like that. Given that our climate is predicted to produce more extreme weather events, which are key in the disasters that we particularly suffer from in Australia, that will mean more of these economic flow-ons, won't it?
Definitely, definitely. And just bear in mind, I have so far talked about only individuals. There is the firm's dimension. There is the business's dimension of this, whole of this. There is a lot of recovery funding going into businesses. The efficacy, the efficiency of these disaster monies in terms of helping businesses come back is yet to be understood. So the economy is, as a whole, is suffering from all these disasters, and we need more research into those as well.
Well, it sounds like you and your group are going to have your work cut out for you, Mehmet. Thank you very much for joining us again on The Money.
Thank you.
Mehmet Yunusoglu is Professor of Economics at Deakin University. A week after the Russian invasion of Ukraine, the Russian economy is in deep trouble. The value of their currency, the ruble, has dived. Interest rates have doubled, they're now at 20%. The stock exchange has been closed for 4 days and there are queues for the ATMs. It's all been caused by Western financial and economic sanctions. Elena Rybakova, the deputy chief economist at the Institute of International Finance, says one of the key sanctions is against the Russian Central Bank.
Well, a big share of reserves of Russia's central bank have effectively been arrested and no longer available to the Central Bank of Russia. Central Bank of Russia had over 640 billion reserves, one of the largest reserve holders in the world. And almost half of it now has been arrested in various accounts from the US to Europe.
So that means those foreign reserves can't be accessed?
Absolutely, you're right. The foreign reserves, a big share of these foreign reserves, cannot be accessed. They cannot be used for interventions. They cannot be used for support of the domestic financial system or the economy. So their options are much more curtailed as a result of the sanctions, almost unprecedented sanctions, on the Central Bank of Russia.
I understand that the EU, the US and the UK have gone further by actually stopping individuals from transacting with the bank in any way.
Well, I think the sanctions are very comprehensive on the Central Bank of Russia. And indeed, it's not only arresting the accounts, but effectively that also means that the counterparties cannot transact with the Bank of Russia, cannot facilitate the Bank of Russia from accessing these accounts. So effectively, they cut off fully until there is a likelihood of de-escalation with Russia.
So what effect is this having in Russia?
We have sanctions on the central bank, which is just discussed. We have sanctions on individual financial institutions, and we also have disconnection from SWIFT of individual institutions. In addition to that, we also have export controls and sanctions on individuals. So all the financial sanctions put together having a devastating effect on the markets in Russia and also on the economy. Ruble has depreciated more than 30%. This week, Moscow Stock Exchange could not open, so effectively there is no trading. And the central bank had to put emergency measures, starting from doubling interest rates on the domestic market to 20%, and on the interbank, liquidity has tightened even further, and also implementing capital controls.
You mentioned SWIFT. I think people have heard of SWIFT, but non-experts have probably heard of it for the first time in the last week. How important is denying access to SWIFT? What does it do?
SWIFT is a global cooperative of international financial institutions. SWIFT is needed for us to be able to communicate what transactions take place, especially on international trade or capital flows. So, for example, if me and you were to transact, I might buy a painting from you and it will be an international transaction. We do need to somehow record what kind of transaction took place. So SWIFT has the global standards and we know exactly what is the name of your bank, what kind of information needs to be transmitted. So it makes it possible to settle on our corresponding accounts that the transaction took place. So if our banks cannot transact and record their transactions via SWIFT, there are alternative options. Well, the alternative options might be like me and you calling each other. Mm. That's not very fast or effective, using Telex maybe, or some new blockchain technologies, but that is still very limited. So effectively, these banks are disconnected from being able to exchange information about their international transactions with other banks.
So it's not that they can't move the money, it's just that they can't exchange the information. And without being able to do that, well, there's just no point in being able to move the money.
Absolutely. If we cannot accurately settle the information on what transactions are taking place, and there are number of millions of transactions happening almost every day and every moment on SWIFT, we have more than 200 countries that are signed up to SWIFT. We have more than 11,000 financial institutions that are participating in SWIFT. Almost every single global institution is there. So it makes it very difficult for Russian banks to interact with the world. Furthermore, SWIFT in Russia is used also for the domestic messaging system. Russia started developing the alternative domestic payments settlement system and also messaging system. But only about 20% of the transactions on the domestic market are going via this domestic system. So they are also facing the challenge of having to switch that from 20 to 100% almost overnight.
But that will almost certainly have teething problems at the very least, and it may not even be possible. So what about the other sanctions? Because I think there are some that actually target individuals.
So indeed, we have sanctions on individuals ranging from government officials to also businessmen or so-called oligarchs in Russia. And they're effectively losing their assets abroad and also access to being able to put their money abroad. So a lot of these individuals gain their wealth from corruption in Russia. Effectively, this is taxpayers' money from Russia that was stolen via kickbacks or directly stolen from the budget. So we also need to ask the question in Europe and the UK, in the US, why did we allow that to happen for so long? And why they managed to get access to the international financial community in order to be able to effectively launder their money?
I think surely the answer to that is that London in particular and New York as well, and probably Switzerland, were making too much money out of the oligarchs and decided to turn a blind eye.
It's very possible. And I think going forward, it will change our approach towards how we look at these people, not just from Russia, but from across the world for these financial centers. They will now be thinking twice whether they would like to be involved with this kind of individuals. So I think the sanctions will also have a sort of secondary effect of being a deterrent for capital centers, for financial institutions, when they think of getting involved with government officials or oligarchs across the world.
Mm. Now, I understand, and there's also export bans, in particular things like dual-use technology that could be used to prosecute the war against Ukraine, but not just those things. What effects will they be having on the Russian economy?
Export bans have changed dramatically in recent years. And what happened also in the area of export bans in the US, but also in especially in Europe, as a result of the action taken towards Russia, cannot be overstated. So it's not only about dual-use technology that you mentioned, but it's going further. It's undermining Russia's ability to progress technologically, to progress in area of research, to progress in area of commodities research and mining, AI, technological, fintech. So I think it will weigh on Russia's productivity over the long term, especially because it is a multinational sanction approach, have committed to abide by these export controls.
What do we know about who is being most affected by the sanctions?
At this stage, it's very difficult to say beyond the Russian economy. So Russian economy and actually common Russian people at the moment appear most affected by the sanctions, because these sanctions have a direct hit on the economy, direct hit on the markets. And to be honest, common Russian people have been affected by sanctions already for a long time, because the authorities prioritized building sort of Fortress Russia, insulating themselves or isolating themselves from the global economy already since the 2014. So common person has been not having access to social care, to education, to healthcare services, because this money was going to the coffers of the government in order to protect themselves.
Right. President Biden, speaking just yesterday, hinted at more sanctions. What else might we see?
We still have further tightening that can be done on the financial sanctions. As you know, not all banks have been put on the SDN list in the US. Mm-hmm. Not all banks lost their access to SWIFT. And many banks still have their access to euros, for example, or trading in other currencies. So these financial sanctions can be tightened further. The next level of sanctions will likely be trade as well. This will be a very severe sanction. It's likely that it will not happen in the area of gas, which is extremely important for Europe, but not, it's important, but not maybe as important as it is for Russia. It might be sanctions on oil.
So most of the coverage of what's been going on in Ukraine have talked about the geopolitics of it. But I'm wondering, as an economist, how damaged is Russia going to be by this, and how long will it take for it to recover?
So these sanctions will have a devastating effect on the economy. I think we're talking about the 90s kind of effect. We're not talking about 2008 crisis. It will likely be worse. And also it's particularly disturbing that in the 90s, there was hope in Russia after this devastating crisis to go forward towards opening and integration and benefiting from the global commodities and integration into global markets. This time around, it seems to be going backwards towards isolation and autarky, and that is particularly worrisome.
Elena Rybakova from the Institute of International Finance. And that's it for this week. The Money is produced by Kate McDonald. Our sound engineer is Emrys Cronin. And I'm Richard Aidy.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.